ancient dusky river. My soul has grown deep like river.
Welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Happy birthday to ya, Langston Hughes. He would have been 111 years old today, and that was Dwight Tribble. I've Known Rivers, one of Langston Hughes' quite popular and famous poems. And not certain exactly what's going on for the first interview. My guest is late in the studio, so I think what we'll do is I will play this interview that I have from this poetry radio archives on Langston Hughes, and hopefully our guest will call in by the time the interview is up, but it's really interesting. It's it's looking at Langston Hughes and his relationship to jazz, and he definitely collaborated musically with musicians, jazz musicians, and, you know, within his work itself, of course, there was a lot of musicality, and this particular radio interview and analysis looks at his poem Weary Blues, and I agree. I mean, it's always wonderful to hear a poet read their work, but sometimes others might perform it a little bit better. But it's a really wonderful excursion, and it's a great interview. And I also want to remind people that there's a lot of great things happening at the 57th Street Gallery tonight, February 1st. There is a tribute to Billy Higgins, great drummer, humanitarian. He founded the World Stage in Leimert Park in South Central Los Angeles. Great place for poetry and visual arts, definitely performance arts for young people as well as older people like adults. And on Saturday, February 2nd, at the West Oakland Branch Library, we're celebrating our 23rd annual African American Celebration through Poetry, and that's from 1 to 4. And at the Bayview Opera House, they are just having so much fun this month, celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And that celebration started at the Bayview Opera House on January 1st, and it's continuing with the artist reception with Bill Doggett, who has a fabulous visual exhibit up that's just phenomenal, that looks at sort of the history and legacy of slavery in this country all the way up to the emancipation and what African people did when they were, when January 1st, 1863 rolled around, and then, and subsequently after the Civil War ended and the Union or the Northerners won. So it's a really wonderful exhibit, and there's going to be music in the evening and other kinds of performances. One of the featured guests is Robert Henry Johnson, wonderful choreographer and writer and poet. So who knows what he has in store. And there are going to be vendors, so it's going to be really nice. So that's also February 2nd, and that's in the afternoon. But again, at the Bayview Opera House, there's just so much going on. There's so much going on just in general. So check out wandaspicks.com, and I'm going to be updating that. But I've got a little tidbit of what's going on there presently, and I'm going to be updating it throughout the month because, you know, it's kind of hard to get it all done and, you know, before the deadline, which was yesterday. No, actually, it was a couple of days ago. So here is Langston Hughes. And Weary Blues meets jazz.
This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, February 11th, 2009. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, when the Weary Blues met jazz. In 1958, Langston Hughes did a unique collaboration with jazz musicians. Hughes read some of his poems to arrangements by Leonard Feather and Charles Mingus.
Droning a drowsy, syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play.
On today's program, we're going to sample some of the tracks of the Weary Blues, a recording from Verve Records. I'm joined by saxophonist and composer Charles Girard and by poet and multimedia performer Holly Bass. Their ensemble, Washington Musica Viva, recently performed a recreation of the Weary Blues with original tracks at Busboys and Poets Cafe in Washington, D.C. Charlie is here with me in Brooklyn, and Holly joins me by phone from Washington. Welcome to Poetry Off the Shelf.
Hello.
Hi.
Now, Holly, Langston Hughes must have been surrounded by jazz his entire life, especially when he lived in Harlem in the 20s. He talks a lot about blues, and a lot of his poems are riffs on blues in one way or another. But do you hear jazz in his poetry?
Oh, I definitely hear jazz and the blues in Langston's poetry. And he would have been exposed to music like that even from early on, from being born in the South. I feel like we have this idea that somehow all of the things we associated with Langston happened in Harlem,
right,
when in reality it was the culmination of his whole life. So by the time he got to New York, he'd already written his first book and had already established those themes of working class black life, of the street, of blues, of jazz in his writing.
Yeah, he had written The Weary Blues, I think, in Washington, D.C.,
yes,
which he hated, by the way, didn't he? He hated,
yes,
D.C.
Yes, he did hate Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
he was very depressed the entire time.
Yeah, well, he lived in a YMCA and was a busboy.
Yeah. Well, actually, the busboy probably, that wasn't the part he hated most. Actually, I think it was the Washington black elite social scene that really got him down.
I don't dare start thinking in the morning. I don't dare start thinking in the morning. If I thought thoughts in bed, them thoughts would bust my head. So I don't dare start thinking in the morning. I don't dare remember in the morning. Don't dare remember in the morning. If I recall the day before, I wouldn't get up no more. So I don't dare remember in the morning.
Hughes is always trying to capture the musicality of black cultural life, whether it was in the speaking cadence of regular folk or in the actual music.
One of the things along those lines that's really obvious is that a lot of the poems are structured just like blues. What is it, Holly? Is it like
a 12-bar blues?
Or I mean, whatever it is. Yeah, it's a 12-bar blues type thing.
Repeat in the same format.
Right, and they're kind of stanzas after stanzas done, you know, that would fit with the blues. It could be sung.
So you jazz musicians, you see something written in that kind of form, you think, I know what to do with this.
Yeah, that it's pretty obvious.
So the beginning of The Weary Blues, droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play down on Lenox Avenue the other night by the pale, dull pallor of an old gas light. He did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues.
With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he plays that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues. Coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues.
Now, so you perform these and with jazz musicians, and you are a performer in many things that you do. So what do you think of Langston Hughes' performance?
I mean, in all honesty,
yeah,
I don't think Langston was the best reader.
Yeah. I was going to say, I've heard his poems many times. They always struck me as a little flat in his reading.
The recording with the music is much more engaging,
right,
than I think. Not every poet is a performer.
Yeah.
And when you hear Langston, he's a writer. And so he delivers his words clearly, but not necessarily with, you know, any sort of great oratorical skill.
I dreamt last night I thought I was in hell. I woke up and looked around me. Babe, your mouth was open like a well. I said, baby, baby, please don't snore so loud. Baby, please, please don't snore so loud. You just a little bit of woman, but you sound like a great big crowd.
Yeah, well, there's something kind of buttoned up about his reading style, and even though the text itself is often very slangy, jazzy, and so on, but there's sort of a contradiction between his presentation and the reality of the words.
Part of his reading style is a reflection that he, as an educated black man, might not want to be seen as mocking working class or less educated folks by trying to sound like them,
right,
when in fact he didn't generally speak in black vernacular or with a strong sort of southern accent. And so I think maybe he was avoiding trying to sound false in that way.
I'm a bad, bad man, 'cause everybody tells me so. I'm a bad, bad man, everybody tells me so. I take my meanness and my liquor everywhere I go. I beat my wife and I beat my side gal too.
The first side of the recording, the first side of the album, because it came out originally as an album, was written and arranged by Leonard Feather. The other side by Charles Mingus. Now, Charlie, they sound different to my ear, but I can't explain why musically. What's the huge difference between these two arrangers of this?
Basically, Leonard Feather has kind of a much older style, almost Dixieland jazz or New Orleans jazz, and then with Mingus, well, it's Mingus. It's very hip and
timeless. It seems so much more.
He's right with us. And I also have the feeling that Mingus's attitude was, well, I'm Charles Mingus. I'm doing Charles Mingus's music. If it works with Langston Hughes poetry, great.
Don't let your dog curb you. Don't let your dog curb you. Curb your doggy like you ought to do, but don't let that dog curb you. You may play folks cheap, act all rough and tough, but a dog can tell when you're full of stuff. Them little old mutts look all scraggly and bad, but they got more sense than some people ever had. Cur dog, vice dog, carry blue, just don't let your dog curb you.
You know, I'm going to go out on a limb here, but I think in African-American poetry in general, there has been an incredibly close relationship and interest on the part of poets and writers to jazz and to music in general. I can't think of a major African-American poet who doesn't write a lot about music.
I would have to agree with you. I mean, we joke, and Washington, D.C. has a really wonderful black writing community, and we used to joke and say, you know, every good poet has to have a Coltrane poem in their pocket. And it would always be this thing of like, well, have you written your Coltrane poem or your sort of, you know, jazz ars poetica?
Right.
So I definitely, even though you may not see as many poets performing with live jazz, it's definitely in the poetry.
Yeah.
And I think that will always be the case.
Holly and Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Holly Bass is a poet and a multimedia performer. Charles Gerard is a composer and saxophonist. You can find out more about Washington Music of Viva on the web at dcmusicofviva.org. The Weary Blues recording of Langston Hughes with Charles Mingus and Leonard Feather is published by Verve. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.
Holly?
Yes.
Oh, thanks for hanging in there. I have myself muted. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine. Yeah, I don't know what happened with regards to the communication, but I'm glad that you're able to join us for a few minutes. Holly Roach, arts administrator, project manager, film curator, and the person that is where the narrative features come in to your mailbox and you decide which ones go into the festival? Or do you have that lucky job?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I manage our call for entries and also try to curate from other festivals to bring in sort of the best that play at other festivals around the country that haven't had a screening in San Francisco, and to be able to bring them here that don't have national distribution yet.
Wow. So how many film festivals are you monitoring currently?
Mostly in California, but I think I went to around four last year.
Mm-hmm.
Also keeping an eye on what is happening in through the media and other film festivals around. And it's great now because I can watch a lot of things online. So that works within our limited budget at SF Indy.
Yeah, SF Indy is just such a phenomenal film festival. I mean, you all do so much. Tell our audience, besides, you know, the Documentary Film Festival, or DocFest, which is coming up beginning, I guess opening night is February 7th?
Yes, it goes February 7th through the 23rd. And it is at the, primarily at the Roxy Theater. We also have some screenings at Brava Theater, and that's opening night is February 7th at the Brava Theater. And we do have some screenings at the Vortex Room and also at 518 Gallery at 518 Valencia Street at 16th, which is around the corner from the Roxy, and there will be special events there going on. And I believe you can get access to that with your ticket stub from SF Indy. And there will be drink specials and a bad art gallery and other parties going on there as well.
Yeah. I've had Jeff on in the past, Jeff Ross, who started SF Indy in 1998. And Faye Dearborn, your colleague, has been a visitor to our studios often. And so it's really great, you know, to get the whole family, you know, Chris in the air. So tell us about this particular festival and some of the other festivals that SF Indy Fest is known for besides DocFest.
Well, I think that this festival, which now is in its 15th year, which is really remarkable, I think. And as I said, we'll be at the Roxy Theater. It runs February 7th through the 23rd, and tickets are available online through our website, which is sfnd.com, or you can purchase them at the box office at the Roxy Theater on 16th Street at Valencia. And I'm really excited. I think we have a stellar program this year. I've been here for about 5 years, and I think it's one of the strongest programs that that I've been around for. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited for our opening night film, The We and the I. It's directed by Michel Gondry, which a lot of people may be familiar with his work from the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind with Kate Winslet and Joe Terry. He is a remarkable director and auteur, and this film is about teenagers in New York City, and it takes place entirely on a bus on the last day of school. And he, the director, Michel Gondry, had collaborated with students in the area with young people to write the script and construct the story and make the film. And it is inventive and funny and authentic. And I think it's a great portrait of urban youth. And I'm really excited. It's a great opening night film, and we're very pleased to be showing it. Mm-hmm. And that's playing on February 7th at the Brava Theater.
Right. And my audience is interested in films that look at the African-American experience. I was wondering if you could tell us about some of the films that focus on that. I believe The We and the I is one of those, as well as the Iceberg Slim film.
I'm sorry?
I believe the We and the I, the opening night film, is a film that looks at that, you know, that.
Yes, well, it features a multicultural cast of young people that are from the Bronx, I believe. And, again, they, from what I understand, they collaborated with the director and the screenwriter on the script, and they sort of play versions of themselves. They all, their characters use their own names in the film, and they all know each other from a community center there. And so that, they're sort of dealing with, I think, issues that they deal with on a regular basis, from the mundane to of who to invite to their birthday parties to more deeper issues of violence in their community and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, the collaborators do feature African-American young people as well as Latino and Asian, and it is a really great cast of non-actors that are all extraordinarily compelling, and I think it is a delightful film, and we're very, very pleased to be showing it from such a renowned director.
Yeah, and another film that was pointed out to me is Iceberg Slim film. Tell us about that. He's a real iconic figure.
That is one. We do have a team of programmers. There's about three or four of us. So I have not actually seen that film yet, but I'm looking forward to it as well, as a documentary, I believe, on Iceberg Slim. And I definitely would recommend. I'm looking forward to seeing that one myself.
Yeah. Do you know when it's screening?
That one is screening on Saturday, February 9th at 5 p.m. And then it screens again Monday, February 11th at 7:15 p.m. And both of those are at the Roxy Theater on 16th Street at Valencia in the Mission.
So since I guess, is it SF India is having its Quinceañera, that's sort of, you know, you're going to be having all these wonderful parties and things. And I remember last year for the SF Indie in, I guess, the one that went through October, I went to the roller skating party and costume ball, which was really fun. And so what kind of special, I mean, I know in the past there have been concerts and all kinds of fun things. What's happening sort of outside of, like, you go to the film and then afterwards there's this fabulous party. Tell us about some of the other sort of ancillary events that happen as a part of this wonderful celebration of film and filmmakers.
SF Indie has always been known for its legendary parties, and you can gain access to those with your ticket stub. And I know that on opening night, February 7th, following the film, The We and the I at the Brava Theater, there will be an opening night party, I believe there at the Brava, that is, again, with that Quinceañera theme, and there's going to be birthday cake and a mariachi band and DJs and, most importantly, an open bar. And that is included with your ticket price. Also, the roller disco party that you were speaking of is happening again this year. That has been quite a tradition at SF Indie. And that will be the second Friday of the festival, so Friday the 15th, at the Women's Building in the Mission, and that's at 8 p.m. Again, I believe that your ticket stub gains you access to those parties. Another legendary party of SF Indie happens on opening weekend, on that first Friday, following there's a screening of The Big Lebowski at 11:45, and every year we have a Big Lebowski party, and there's bowling and costumes, and it's really fun to go to because you can hear people screaming out lines from the movie pretty much all night long. And so that will coincide with the screening at 11:45. The party starts at 8 p.m. at 518 Valencia, which is around the corner from the Roxy Theater on Valencia Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And there's you all usually have a really wonderful selection of shorts. Local filmmakers are always featured. And, yeah, we're out of time, but if you want to maybe in conclusion, you know, talk about any special, you know, local filmmakers that are being featured this particular season for the first time, any wonderful jewels or finds that you have come across as a programmer?
Well, I do know that it looks like they're I did want to talk about a program that is playing Saturday, February 9th at 2:45 p.m. called Uncanny Shorts, Past and Present. And there will be a panel discussion following that with Lynn Hirschman and Mary Elena Clark that sort of explores the San Francisco tradition of experimental filmmaking. I think that will be pretty extraordinary. Again, that's on Saturday, February 9th at 2:45 at the Roxy Theater in the Mission. And really, I encourage people to explore the whole program, which is available on our website, which is sfnd.com. Like I said, I think we have one of the strongest programs that we've had in many, many years, and I'm very pleased to be presenting so many of these films. It's hard to put it into a few minutes. So, again, I would encourage everyone to go to our website, sfnd.com, and check out the program, and I hope to see everyone at some films.
All right, super. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and looking forward to seeing you in the cinema.
Yes, thank you, Wanda.
All right, you take good care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine.
It's fun to have a chance to meet.
Yes. It's been, wow, it's been almost 12 months.
It's been a very long time. I can't believe it. I met you a year ago at the Empowering Women of Color Conference at Houston Vice School.
I know. And here we are.
Finally.
Yeah, you got a whole nother book written.
Yes.
It's been that long.
And I'm bringing it. I've been doing a lot of performing. Actually, the piece that you heard at the conference last year, I'm a Survivor, that piece is going to be in the new book. So everything that I've written in the last year or so is going to be in the new book that's coming out this summer.
That is so awesome. And, it's so wonderful to have you on, too, because, you know, today is Langston Hughes' birthday. And you know, here you are in the studio, you know, a poet, to talk about your work. And just the whole idea of having, you know, access to poetry, which is a language that allows you to tell us some things that, you know, we might not know about yourself and know about life if you didn't have, you know, this kind of facility, because everyone can't write poetry.
Right.
It's not easy to write poetry, at least I don't think it's easy. Some people say it's easy, but I find it kind of difficult.
I think it really depends. You know, like I always grew up loving to read and write. And, you know, if I wanted to be an English major, but then I realized I'm going to have to write papers anyway, so I decided to do African American Studies. And so a lot of this, because that's my, I'm a African American Studies major as well as my master's in education, I want to be an educator. I call myself a professor through my poetry, so I speak on life, which is why the first book is called Signs of Life, Past, Present, and Future. I speak on things, whether it's politics, from a political point of view, student point of view, single mom, because I am a single mother, mm-hmm. and just living in, growing up in Oakland, Berkeley, what I've seen. And I just take those things that I see, and I'm just fortunately, and I'm blessed to be able to take those things and transform them into words. Mm-hmm. And that's just been a passion of mine, reading and writing. I just love it. So it's great to be able to say, wow, I have a book on myself.
Right, right. Yeah. And do you have both your degrees from UC Berkeley, your African American Studies degree and your Master's in Education?
Yes.
Mhm. Yeah. Nice. And from your bio, it says that you work with urban youth and through a program of some sort or in a school. Where do you work with young people?
I work with the City of Oakland and Office of Collective Education, and I work in a program I work in West Oakland, I used to work in West Oakland, but I work in East Oakland now in the Inclusion Center. But mm-hmm. I work with students. I used to work with students. The inclusion program that I'm in right now, I work with students with a variety of disabilities, not just deafness. It's just deafness. And I just, what I do with the kids is I tutor them, mentor them, help them with their homework, and I show them that, you know, there's a way, you know, if I'm from Oakland, if I can make it and I have a disability, which is a hearing loss, you guys can do it too. Mm-hmm. And I keep it real with them, and I enjoy what I do. I want to be a teacher, but unfortunately, that's a hard chair to get into, at least a community college. And, mm-hmm. I'm able to do my teaching at a association center and tell students their real history, how to get to college, how to get a job, and I'm able to still do what I love with the kids, as well as show them, look, I also publish a book. I have a few students that's like, why are you working this job and you have a book? I said, hold up, it's not that easy. But just to show them that anything is possible when mm-hmm. you put your mind to it. And that's what I love about these kids, it's working with these kids, is giving them that inspiration and motivating them to do better.
Right, yeah. So your first book, or is that your first book, Signs of Life, Past, Present, and Future? Is this your first? Okay, yeah. Tell stories of the daily life of a lover, student, worker, mother, and many other identities. And you write that you're sharing experiences that people go through in this society, whether they are your personal experiences or experiences that you've observed others experiencing. Well, that was kind of redundant. that's not in the writing, that's me. These are stories you write that people can identify with or learn from. And the title has several meanings, you write. American Sign Language is one of the languages that you use to communicate and is a part of your life. And the other meaning, signs of life, past, present, and future, is for the elements of the earth. And the last meaning is for the experiences that occur in people's lives. The past, you write, is a reflection of who we are, who we were, and where we came from. The present is our current state of mind and leaving the past behind us to move on to the brighter side of our lives. And the future is where dreams come from and all of our hard work is accomplished. Without past and present, there's no future. You perform every week on Wednesday at Hot Water Cornbread's Mouth Off at the Air Lounge in Oakland. What did you share this past Wednesday on the eve of Black History Month? And where are you? Do you have like a unlimited engagements this 28 days beginning today?
this past Wednesday, I did a poem for Valentine's Day. It was my first erotic poem that I've ever done. So it was, I really stepped out of the box. And I.
How did that feel for you, stepping out of the box?
Is it appropriate to do on here?
No, don't do it on here, but I'm just saying, no. How did it feel for you to step out of the box?
It felt great. It was liberating.
Mm.
And I like the fact that I can't be in a box anyway. And that's my motto, is you can't label me or put me in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that I'm not just labeled as a pro-black poet or
mm-hmm.
a love poet. I'm just a poet. I just speak on what I see, and I love the fact that I can do any genre. It doesn't matter. And
mm-hmm.
But I do have a poem that I do in times of Black History Month. And it's a poem that I loved, and I wrote this poem a year ago because it was we were coming up on President Obama's reelection, and
mm-hmm.
they were worried about not getting enough voters. And so I decided to say, well, I'm going to take some topics of what I wrote in some papers, and I was going to put in this poem. And some of it is topics from the African American Studies class. So if you don't mind, I would like to put one next.
Yeah, sure, no problem. And the connection is kind of wobbly sometimes. So if that happens, I'm going to stop you so that you could do the poem again so that everyone could hear it more clearly, okay?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I can go ahead?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. I'm a survivor of the transatlantic and South American slave trade. I'm a Protestant survivor of Red Stone slavery. No choice but to carry my babies into this horrible world. My babies being ripped from my uterus and arms. My husband, auctioned off a lint full of balance. I know that because of my skin complexion, I was working in the house saying yes, master, and acting like I was his law subject. Yes, his law subject. Subject to all kinds of abuse. While taking care of his family, I'm learning how to read and write or listen to his conversation from one to others. While I watch his clothes outside and pass by the other slaves, I sing, way in the water, to communicate to the others that the water is the key to freedom. I'm a survivor of slaves learning how to read and write. At night, my work is never done. I teach others how to read and write, but teach them how to hide it so we don't lose the battle to freedom. Certain trees bore strange fruit, and even though they're not grown in front of us, they're grown in someone's backyard. I'm a survivor of the civil rights movement and God's attacking me because I want to vote. I'm a Protestant survivor of the Black Power movement, Black Panther Party, Power to the People, and police brutality and FBI instigations and infiltration. I lead it down for a cause, and two rappers on two coasts use the cause of war within our community. They say the best way to hide something from us is by putting it in a book. After all the things I went through to teach us how to read and write in slavery, these two things were thoughtfully becoming useless in our community. I'm proud to be from Oakland and Berkeley, two cities that represent change and revolution. I'm Black, not African American. I don't identify with the Africans because I don't know what tribal reason I'm from. Because of the one drop rule, I don't know who I was at first. I refuse to call myself an American because I don't want to call myself something where the country doesn't even want me. They keep finding ways to keep me oppressed to the state. We fought for the right to vote, and the moment that we earned it, we're not registering and getting out there. Our right to vote and freedom may be taken away because we're complacent and we don't know that war will break out in this country just to put us back into slavery. We've been experiencing institutional slavery and racism for the past 50 years, but it's about to get real because we have a Black president and he's not backing down. They're afraid that he's going to change America for the better and they can't have that. It's getting tougher and tougher for us to vote and express ourselves. There may be 99% of us, but that 1% controls everything. I'm a fighter and I refuse to give up. I learned from all the people that fought for us to be here today, dead or alive, that we have the right to live freely. I'm a survivor of all these things because my ancestors made this country we're being raised out of its history. Pick up a book and learn about the struggle that people went through just for us to be here today. I refuse to let all the movements and those that lay down their lives die in vain. Thank you.
Wow, that's wonderful. Wow, that is so beautiful. Yes, it's got so much history in there, and I really you sort of stopped me in that part when you said, you know, I'm black, I'm not African American. That part right there stopped me for a minute, and then you were talking about the president and about voting and about reading. Yeah, it really took us on a really great journey there. Do you teach poetry with the young people that you work with in the program? Do they do writing with you?
I used to teach writing when I was working more hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do is I try to show them my work,
mm-hmm.
and let them know I'm there for them when they're ready to write something. Because a lot of my students are older and they're in college right now. So
uh-huh.
I try to get them to come back and work with me. But I would love to teach a writing class. I really would. I would really like to do a creative writing. And, you know, especially with these youth, because they listen to rap music or
mm-hmm.
even music. And I want them to know that's what poetry is. If you're listening to music, that's what poetry is. It's
mm-hmm.
just poetry, you know, words to beat an instrument. So it really goes hand in hand. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I try to tell them about venues where they can perform open mic, where, like, I can be at that for people that don't have an age requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because Air Lounge is for 21 and over. So I tried, uh-huh. if one person wanted to go on a mic so bad, I had to find a place for her.
Mm-hmm.
Go because she was 18.
Okay, well, you know, they have Holler Back at Eastside, and then at La Pena there's poetry readings that are on Wednesday in the Cafe Poetry, and it's all ages.
Hmm.
Yeah. Because language, you know, is musical. I mean, there's a musicality in the language, you know, that's why all of our cultures were once oral. You know, we didn't write things down because the musicality of the language made memory and memorization really easy. You know, we just started jotting stuff down more recently.
Why don't you
talk a bit about, how, you know, you talk about how American Sign Language is one of your languages and you have hearing loss. You could hear a little, but so you're not completely deaf, but talk about sort of going from, you know, being, you know, I guess being able to hear and then going into sort of another sort of type of listening and having to learn another language and what that does with regards to sort of how you're perceived. I mean, so, you know, you almost like have a double whammy. You know, you're African-American or you're black, and then you're a woman, and then you are a hearing-impaired woman. And, you know, you got these different layers that one has to fortify oneself against because, you know, racism is real, despite 150 years post-Emancipation Proclamation.
Yes, so I was born with an umbilical cord wrapped around my neck,
mm-hmm.
and that's how I lost my hearing.
Mm.
I've been fortunate. They were able to detect my hearing loss at 6 months,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to give me hearing aids, and I do have hearing as you can see.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't learn sign language until I was 4 years old, and my mom took me out. I was involved in a deaf part of the classroom in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, it was different because they categorized us by hearing loss. And as I got older, then they categorized us by, in a sense, our education level.
Mm.
And then growing up, I was able to be mainstream in a regular classroom. Which is, you know, a special ed student being in a regular classroom, not being in a special day class all day long. And the thing is that I was able to be teased by deaf people because I could hear. And it's kind of sad because it's like being biracial, and I can hear a lot, but I can't hear enough. And I'm caught in the middle of both worlds. So I could, I used to be teased a lot. And although my family was always supportive of me, although my family did not learn sign language, but because back then there wasn't enough information, the doctors assumed and told my mom, don't learn sign language because we want her to rely on her hearing, thinking that if I became reliant on sign language, I would lose my hearing. Which, you know, it's like a muscle, which you don't train it. So if you don't, what you don't do, you lose. And I was the one that would go home and teach my family sign language. And as I got older, my family, I come from a family of teachers, educators, so they are very strong in education. They believe in going after your goals, going for your dreams. So one of the things was, I've always wanted to go to UC Berkeley since I was a young girl. And my family, they went to Southern University in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I'm sorry. I want to go my own way. I want to do this for me. And they were like, well, do what you want to do. That's your dream. That's what you want to do. As long as you're going to school, what happens? And thanks to my family being supportive of me, and then I left the Oakland School District and moved to Berkeley and went from elementary all the way to high school in Berkeley School District. Mm-hmm. It made being around different people. Berkeley is very different from Oakland. Berkeley is very accepting of disabilities and things like that. So my hearing loss wasn't a hearing loss anymore. It didn't become an issue. People started to see me as an individual. And that's what I always explain to people. Some people ask me, what is it like to be black deaf person? I said, well, I don't see myself like that. Although that is what I am, I'm just a human being. This, my skin color doesn't define me. I define it. My hearing loss doesn't define me. I define it. And I try to change people's perspective because I am the first from the Oakland and Berkeley deaf program to go to UC Berkeley and Stanford University. Mm-hmm. And to be the first and black person especially, that was it's a big thing. And I try to show people because people are like, wow, I never met a person with a disability before. I didn't know you used to work. And although I guess I could take that as a compliment, I'm like, there's nothing wrong with me. I just can't hear well, and I use this example. Just because a person wears glasses does not make them blind. They just use glasses to enhance what they can't see. Well, same thing for my hearing aid. I'm not completely deaf. I can hear without them. I just can't hear as well. So, you know, you can still talk to me. Just make sure I lift for you do sometimes, or we can write it down. But for the most part, I can hear pretty good. And I try to explain to people, also, not all hearing loss are the same. I have students whose hearing loss, they hard of hearing, but they can hear a little bit better than me. And then you have some that can't hear anything at all. And we have different frequencies that we can hear. And mine just happens to be I can't hear the high frequency. So, you know, it's a this category, and I just like people to know that, you know, you have to ask people their questions because not all deaf people know sign language. You know, people lose their hearing later on and they get, you know, they didn't learn sign language. So, you know, I try to just enlighten people on the whole aspect of having a hearing disability. It's a lot. I know it's a lot, but you know, it's, you know, but like I said, I'm always just trying to
Well, you know, there's a whole you know, deaf culture, and everything is not the same, and everything doesn't translate, you know, cross-culturally. So, you know, you're a part of a whole lot of different worlds within your own person. And you're able to, like, move, I mean, not just geographically, but also, you know, physically and philosophically, you know, in various realms that a lot of people can't move. You know, there are some people that stay in their own circle because that's where they feel most comfortable. They don't necessarily want to stretch or open themselves up to the type of misunderstandings that come when people just don't know and have all these preconceived notions about what it means to be, to have, for someone to be different and to access the world empirically in different ways, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was wondering if you want to share share another poem with us, and then we'll give everyone your website so they can stay in touch and know when that new book is coming, you know, going to be hitting the stands, and we'll have to have you on again to talk about that book.
Okay.
And do some readings, and definitely I'm going to come see you on a Wednesday, and particularly you know, to get a taste of that Joy Erotica poet.
Well, please do come, let me know, and that way I will do that one just for you.
Oh, okay,
I try to switch it up every week, you know, because I never know who's in the audience. I try to switch it up, especially because I'm a regular there.
Yeah.
But if someone comes, and I know they're coming to hear a specific poem,
mm-hmm.
I will perform it for them.
Mm-hmm.
So this last poem I sent out to is, I'm trying to think. I think I'll do a romantic one, if you know. So it's called Two Royal Halves, and this one is in my book, Songs of Life. Your head, chasing your mane, is your domain. Your stamina, you cut your own hair, still has your strength. Full of thoughts and fears, you could be ready to flow through your mouth and speak. Your eyes, a beautiful brown and straight, I can't describe. Your lips, full and powerful. They amaze people because of the things you say. Bring people closer to you because of your smile, or make them run away because you speak the truth. Your truth when the person truth stares out of the shadows. Your face is a golden brown, so pure and beautiful, soft yet tough, a balance in the life you live. Your hands are strong to protect yourself and others, and to create and bring to life the thoughts you've created. Your chest and stomach made of steel and gentle to feel. Your legs are muscular and dashing. Altogether, you're a warrior, a king. Everything about you says leader and power. So know that one day I'll be joined with you, bring a sense of light out of you. Revelations of my destination, past, present, and future. Attracted to you to rewrite history in the present time and live the life of ancient kings and queens from lifetimes ago. You're the combined person that I dreamed of, a person I thought didn't exist. You've been in my life all along. My grandparents represented you and I, a marriage that I've always honored. The signs were all there. I'm aware of them. Only have to bring them to life to show that I'm worthy. I know who I am. I'm on foot to learn it. This is truth. Body of a warrior goddess. Eyes to reflect and deflect when I'm thinking and feeling. My hands ready to fight, although I don't. My mouth, tongue twitch because my brain processes so fast that I want to speak everything into existence. Yet I hold back in case the wrong thought comes out, but the truth is never held back. My chest, safe for my child to run to because she remembers the nourishment it provides. My womb, strong enough to carry a warrior and voice and hips and thighs to support it. My legs are muscular for running and going the distances that I'm destined to go. My hair remains altered to show my loyalty and attractive interest. I'll be sharing the throne with you. Too proud to be a peaceful people brought into the distance to show the world that there are generous people who want to help others. They are listening because we command attention and respect. They are bowed down to us because we've been living amongst them to show how people can come from nothing and get to the highest place only because they were destined. And it is the late King Marie once said, I'm young and I'm old. I'm rich and I'm poor. I feel like I've been on this earth many times before. I used to be an queens and the artists out by the sea, rainbow colored people, happy love. Thank you.
Oh, wow. That is, you're just such a great, great performer. My goodness. And we're on the air. Wow. People really need to catch you in the flesh. My goodness.
I would love for you to come see me. I was definitely super posted. I plan on trying to be at the Empowering Women of Color Conference. I'm trying to debate if I want to host a workshop, a writing workshop. So
oh, nice. So when is it this year, the Empower Women of Color Conference?
Yeah, March 15th.
March 15th?
Yes.
Okay,
on
cool.
On Saturday.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, last year was really nice, really, really nice. Mm-hmm. Oh, that'd be great if you taught a workshop, a writing workshop. I would totally be in the house with my pencils and my paper.
Yes,
get a poem out of it. That'd be so cool. Yeah, I love poetry workshops. I always get a poem out of it.
Yes. You know,
yeah.
And it's a great way to just, even if it's, and that's what happened with my book. It was started off as a journal.
Mm-hmm.
Someone looked at my journal and was like, you know, this stuff is very good. I'm sure somebody out there that I identify with. And that's all it was. I just took a collection of my journal, composed it, and published it, and that's how easy it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of work, but it was all
right.
My effort, and it was just worth it.
Yeah. So your website is Joy Elaine. joyelan.webs.com, and that's where people can actually see your book, and you have a whole lot on that website. And then you have another website that was linked to your name at your Facebook page. Would you like people to just go to Joy Elaine, or do you want them? Oh, that's where they can buy the book, at Ex Libris.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
As well as Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, they have the hard copies as well as the Kindle Nook, and I think it's available on the iPad and other e-readers. You just have to type in Joy Elaine, JoyElaine.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it will appear, and my book is available. And if you're in the Bay Area, feel free to email me on my website as well as on my author page on Facebook, Joy Long.
Joy Long.
And I'm selling books for $10 on my own, hard copies, and I'm autographing it. And I would gladly mail them to you, but that's a little bit extra. But if you live in the Bay Area and I can meet up with you like at a Starbucks or something, I'm glad to do that for you. And I really do, because it's about giving back to the fans as well. And I'm trying to do it. I'm just, you know, trying to get out there and accommodate people any way I can.
Right. So on the Wednesday, the hot butter cornbread reading, what time is that? Is that 6, 7, 8? What time is it?
Wednesday night?
Wednesday, mm-hmm.
It's from 8 to 11 p.m.
8 to 11, mm-hmm.
Yes, and it's $5 to get in. And I must say, there's less dress dress dress. You cannot wear any shoes or any sweats. And that's a great thing, because we want to attract a professional style at Care Lounge. And that's a great way to network as well.
Right. Okay. All right, cool. And tell us again where the Air Lounge is.
It is on 9th and Washington, on the corner downstairs. And please don't be alarmed, but 9th Street and Washington. And it's across by the Oakland Marriott. And just go downstairs, and that's where we are.
Okay, super. Well, thank you so much for blessing the air here with your wonderful presence, Joy Elaine. And have a great Black History Month.
Yes, thank you so much, and I'm so happy we finally were able to do it, and I look forward to seeing you and watching you.
Hi, super. And I'm looking forward to your writing workshop next month.
Well, I hope I did it. I got to apply for
it. But just tell them you got people that want to take it.
Well, then, okay, I will.
All right. You take care.
You too.
All right. Peace and blessings. Bye. good morning, Getty. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. And you?
I'm fine. So am I killing your name, or is that how you say it?
No, you said it right.
Oh, super. Okay, I didn't try the last name. How do you do your last name?
Feline.
Feline, okay. Oh, my goodness. Your film is just so beautiful. Oh, my
goodness.
Thank you. It was just like brought tears to my eyes, and I had to go back and watch certain parts again and listen to certain parts again. I love your narrative in the beginning and the end, about the beginning, just sort of an overview, and then Broken Stones. Oh, by the way, I'm just talking like everyone knows who you are. By the way, we're speaking to filmmaker Getty Feline. Feline, and her film Broken Stones is a part of the African Film Festival out of New York, which is on tour at the Pacific Film Archive, Berkeley Art Museum, Pacific Film Archive, and her film actually closes this year's African Film Festival. It's actually African Diaspora, and she is in town, so you can actually meet the director on February 5th. I believe the screening is at 7, is that correct?
Yes, it's at 7. Mm-hmm. The screening starts at 7 with a documentary from Africa called Under These Roofs.
Mm-hmm.
Under This Roof, and my film follows that film, but people should show up for both films.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. So now back to your film. it's just I love the classical music, and I'm like, what is this film going to be about? Because I didn't read the description first,
right.
And I didn't know that it was going to be looking at this historic cathedral that was damaged during the earthquake 3 years ago, January 12th. And so I'm just looking at this beautiful architecture and thinking, did I see this cathedral when I was in Haiti? And I just thought about the whole idea of disaster tourists. I'm like, that sounds so horrible. It sounds as horrible as the NGOs, the 5,000 of them, and they're not 5,000 problems. It sounds like buzzards, you know, picking at the flesh. I mean, it's just like, but I got over that because I wasn't a disaster tourist. I was actually a person taking money and giving it to folks and taking baby clothes and giving it to mothers in these camps and meeting with these wonderful, heroic women who have suffered.
Matt, thank you so much.
Oh, you know, hey, we're the same people.
Haiti needs people like you.
Yeah, and also I had colleagues from the College of Alameda. Students did fundraisers, and colleagues gave me sleeping bags and blankets, and we took money. We gave money to John Restill before he passed. We gave money to him for his program, you know, for the orphans that whose parents were killed because of their political activism. And so I'm really happy we were able to do that before he made his transition, you know, so untimely. God, he was so young.
Wow.
Yeah. And we visited. I was able to visit with the women who were in some of the camps, like the ones right there in Port-au-Prince and the ones nearby, some of the larger ones. And these women had all suffered sexual violence as well, prior to the camps and also during their stay in the camps. And they wore these whistles around their necks, and they had these badges. And so that was really, that was just really horrific. And since I had some money, I was able to give some of the women money for medicine and money to a mother to take her child to what she called a proper doctor, so she could get his skin rash diagnosed, because it was just really spreading all over his body because of the dirty water and unsanitary conditions. And then I was able to send her more money. Uh-oh. Oh, Yeti is gone. Well, she'll call us back. I'm just talking.
No, I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Oh, okay, good.
No, I'm here. Oh. I'm listening to you.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. And so, and then because I had an ally on the ground, I was able to send more money when I got back home when we found out that it wasn't enough. So, but it's just so heart-wrenching. And your film is just so beautiful. It's just so poetic. And so lyrical, and just long enough, you know? And I just love all these heroes that you share with us, particularly the paraplegic man and the women who are entrepreneurs that are sitting around just sort of holding it together and holding each other up. That's just so beautiful. And then the processions remind me of my hometown, New Orleans, you know, the women waving the white paper, that's like, you know, New Orleans, you know, they wave their fans. They also wave their white handkerchiefs and then the brass band. You know, that's straight out of my hometown. So it's like, oh, it's just so beautiful. Anyway, okay. So let me introduce you properly. Getty was born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and reared in America and came of age cinematically in Paris, France. And she's an award-winning Haitian-American filmmaker, with a very eclectic and rich background in the film and television industry. Her career took root while in graduate school in Paris in 1991, and her work as associate producer for the series, how do you pronounce that?
Écrire contre l'oubli, Writing Against Forgetting.
Mm-hmm. To commemorate the 30th anniversary of Amnesty International. And it's really interesting, this whole thing around memory. It resonates in this film as well, and that's what I really like, you know, when you're narrating the beginning and in the end about this whole thing around memory and how sometimes, you know, the architecture or the place or the thing holds the energy, and that's even echoed in when you're talking to one of the scholars, I think the writer, who says, you know, the women are tapping on the columns, because tell us our audience about that a little bit.
Right, it's that scene where we're talking to Pierre Cliton. He's a writer and journalist and very and an activist who's involved in education since he's been back to Haiti because he was exiled during the Duvalier regime, and it was a pleasure talking to him. I just felt like I could make a film around him alone, and he's just so intelligent. He's just so articulate. And every time I would just, like, ask him one question and they would go off on one thing, but then he would pick up whatever was going on around him and comment on it. And while I was talking to him, these women were knocking on the stone of the church, I mean, the remnants, you know, and they were, you know, as though they were calling, you know, for whatever was inside to answer their prayers. And he comments on that. He talks about the energy of these places, and it comes from animism, actually, that every inanimate object has a life, basically. The tree has a life, the stone has a life, and so on and so forth. So that energy is really their presence. And he told me a story which did not fit into the film, was that Toussaint Louverture, one of our national heroes, always had a stone in his pocket. And when his mambo, which is a voodoo priestess, wanted to get in touch with him, the stone would ring, basically. It's like the ancestor of the telephone.
Wow.
And so that's a piece of history that I didn't know about, but I, you know, it's in all folklore, and apparently it's real, but who can say it isn't? And so he would know that his priestess, who was also his advisor, would want to talk to him, so he would go to her.
Yeah,
so the power of the stone, basically.
Right. Yeah. There. And then, you know, the title of your film, you know, Broken Stones, and then the stones of the edifice that, you know, we revisit repeatedly, you know, within the film. But let me continue reading your bio, just to make sure I get it all out there. So since the, you know, the piece Right Against Forgetting, which was like your debut, you've worked on over 70 hours of documentary and narrative films, and you've worn many hats, which I think is great, because you know how to do all the different aspects of filming and film production: distributor, marketing, outreach director, screenplay reader, voiceover narrator, curator, and teacher. And you've written and directed several personal pieces, many of which are featured on your website, bellmoonproductions.com. And you write of yourself that you're a postmodern gypsy, a hybrid. Your trajectory and cultural identity pretty much pervades your sensibility as a filmmaker. You write, as a child of immigrants, you always find yourself attracted to and gravitating around the same reoccurring themes of the unending search for home, foreignness, loss, and memory. And one of the lines that I just love in the film is, which is, I believe, a Creole saying, without memory, we are blind. And then I add, we must become clairvoyant, because that's a part of the next translation. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your film and this place that you take us to, this cathedral that holds so much for yourself, as well as for the people that you introduce us to. And you also, you know, talk about, you know, the first general, Jean-Jacques Dessalines.
Right. Well, the impetus for the film really came from the fact of not seeing enough images of Haiti after the quake. I mean, like, right after the quake, we saw a lot of images, very sensational images of disaster, of rescuers rescuing people. We saw the dead bodies. And then the news reporting stopped, and so 6 months went on, and we were not seeing anything. And I was extremely curious about how my compatriots were mitigating this disaster, how they were negotiating this disaster to return to normalcy. So, and I wanted to know. Basically, it really came from that selfish point of view and that selfish desire. And I decided to go make a film about this. And I was lucky because I had pitched a project the year prior to a friend of mine in France who was working on a series around great churches and cathedrals around the world. The series didn't get picked up, but they picked up two shows, and one was mine, and the other one was on a church in Moscow. And so I, when I got the funding to make the film, I went to Haiti and decided to really set the whole entire film within the cathedral, because I felt that the cathedral could become a character in itself. And it allowed me also the space where I could use the cathedral as a kind of, like, you know, forum, you know, like in the back in, you know, the ancient Greek, where people could come and speak about the society and rant and you know, and and speak about their desires for the country that they wanted. And so that was the space for me. It became this really very democratic space, not just a religious place, but a place where people can actually speak about, you know, speak their minds. And that's what I try to do throughout the film is that's why we go back several times in there, is each time to take someone through another door of the cathedral. Hello?
Geographical location is a strong symbol for my native city, but also for the entire country. It is in this very neighborhood, between Rue Courte and Rue du Docteur Aubry, that the city of Port-au-Prince was founded in 1749. And just a few feet away from Notre-Dame, in the old cathedral, is where Jean-Jacques Dessalines, one of the country's liberators, was crowned the first emperor of Haiti in 1804. But for me, The reconstruction of the cathedral had a deeper signification. It was a perfect opportunity to talk about the recovery of the Haitian self in one of the most densely populated and most devastated sectors of the capital. Our existence as a people is fraught with hardships that date back long before January 12, 2010. From repressive regimes to floods and hurricanes, or everything at once. However, given its monstrous aspect and the countless lives it engulfed in just 35 seconds, the earthquake remains one of the most violent events in our history. As for Notre Dame, the death toll was particularly heavy. The Archbishop, the General Vicar, 35 members of the congregation, and 16 members of the choir all perished on that day.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, I can. I don't know what happened, but we got disconnected. I'm sorry about that. I don't know.
Oh, no, that's okay. It happens, you know. So, you know, you just call back in, which you did, and it just so happens that I had prepared a little clip.
This is great.
to share with our audience, you know, where,
which
you know, I've been...
Which basically answers the question you asked me.
Right. Well, tell us the film
does it all for me. I don't have to talk.
Yes, you do have to talk. So tell us about, you know, the other wonderful subjects you introduce us to, the wonderful hero, you know, who talks about the classism within the edifice, which I think
Well, he's called Tipi, and he's a homeless guy who's been living around the cathedral, on the streets across from the cathedral, for the last 12 years, and he is also proof that the first responders of the earthquake were Haitians themselves, because we didn't have rescuers in the country. So it was Haitians rescuing other Haitians out of the rubble. And I remember us going to the cathedral and scouting and looking for individuals that we would like to be part of the film and so on, and him sort of like, you know, coming around to us and looking at what we were doing kind of suspiciously, until one day, you know, he approached us and started to talk to us, and he was telling us what he did on that day. But you know how like people like always talk, you know, you don't know if it's true or if it's not true. And then people would come up to me afterwards and say, you see this guy over there with his one leg, he is a true hero, he rescued so many people. And it turns out that his story was really like was authentic. And he told us, you know, I said, do you want to be part of the film? And he was like, yes, I mean, you know, I'll speak to you. And then the day that we went to film him, on one of the days, he just like basically just took us along. You can see like in the film, it's like it's not a, you know, question and answer kind of like interview. It's him guiding us through this cathedral and through the different, you know, paths of the day of the disaster, basically, and what he did. And then later on, he said, I'm going to take you somewhere else. And he wanted us to follow him up to the very top part, the balcony, which is very difficult. But he goes up there without a problem. I mean, he's up there like in less than 5 minutes. And meanwhile, my husband, who is the DP on the film, and my son, who did the sound, are trying to climb up after him. And they decided that they had to go back down because it was just too dangerous. So when we came back down, and so we filmed him from the bottom, and so he's way up there like that, and it looks actually much better than if we were, you know, if we had gone up with him, it would not have had the same impact and the same effect, because he's up there sort of like, you know, like in Notre Dame and you know, the story of Victor Hugo, with him like being kind of like Quasimodo, who is like, you know, the owner of this cathedral. And so, and he tells us the story of how, you know, like, you know, up here where he is now is not a place where the poor could come, because that was the place that was reserved for the rich. So it gave the sense of, like, this place that was, you know, like a house of prayer has become also this very democratic place where everyone can come to, and that's what I liked about the space. I mean, I'm deeply saddened to see the place in the state that it's in, but there was a new birth to these ruins, basically, and mm-hmm. it was a space where people could actually come and talk, and it became alive, actually. The space was much more alive after the quake than it was before, I have a feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, meeting, you know, the woman, the older woman that he said, yeah, and, you know, she had been hit in the head or something, and or no, her arm
right.
had been broken. And he
yeah.
he carried her over, and I'm like, wow. And then he said,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure if it was him or maybe another one of your subjects said, you know, right before the earthquake, people had been praying and singing,
right.
and then the building fell on top of them, and they died.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, the top part, because it was a Tuesday. The earthquake was a Tuesday afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and usually when there's mass every morning, but then, mm-hmm. you know, the space is also a space that's used by the three religions. I mean, it's
oh.
a Catholic institution, but the Protestants, they come, they don't go, like, beyond the gates, but they stay next to the cross. And they have, like, these prayer sessions, you know, like they come and they fast for the day and they sing and they pray. And so they have, and these were the people who got hit with a huge part of the steeple, basically, that fell on the prayer group. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just, we don't, like, right now the death toll is, like, you know, 300,000, but we have, like, no idea. It could even be more, you know, in terms of people that were never counted, you know?
Yeah. And then the cholera, you know, is taking others more.
Right. No, but it's a huge disaster with a lot of other repercussion, because people have died even, like, after the quake due to cholera, due to the injuries and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and due to
the
stress of the disaster, I'm sure.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. And I want you to tell our audience about how the screening went in Haiti, you know, because you just got back just in time for this screening, but you were able to show the film for the first time there, I believe, in Port-au-Prince, and,
mm-hmm.
and how it was received. And I was wondering, were any of the celebrities in the house for the screening, and what did they think of how you depicted them? And I'm really interested in the man who talked about traditional religion, and he's one of your earlier interviews in the cathedral. And then you had someone who was talking about, you know, restoration and things like that, as you had the hero was talking about how, you know, if they don't do something about this bell and this rock, it's going to fall
right.
on somebody's head. And meanwhile, this other guy saying, well, we got to do this, we have to do that. And I'm thinking, like, whoa, somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
You jump
yeah.
through all these bureaucratic hoops.
Right. The screening went well. It was very magical. Like, you know, Haitians are very unforgiving and extremely critical. And this is my first film in Haiti, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so so I'm going there, you know, like, very, you know, timidly, you know, and trying to, you know, share my work with my compatriots, but at the same time very timidly, you know, doing so very timidly, because I know that if it's no good, they will not hesitate to tell you. So I was very, very nervous, and at the end of the screening, the applaud and just, you know, the comments afterwards was extremely warm. It was a very deeply moving experience, because people felt like I gave them a sense of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the truth of what is going on still in the country, and also they relive the day, but at the same time there's a sense of hope in there. And then, you know, one man said to me that we cry, we laugh at the same time, and you've given us, you know, that day, you've given us a sense of what it was like, and you've given us also a message of hope. And I was extremely moved, and the people really got the film. I mean, it was my first real real, like, all Haitian audience. There were some foreigners there as well who came to the screening. But the thing was that, you know, they laughed in the right places and sort of like, you know, and you would hear people go, oh, or they'd go, you know, so you know that they, you know, like, you know that they got it, you know.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of reaction that, I didn't get in other screenings. So I just was like chuckling to myself because I sometimes, like, I've watched the film like each time now because it's a different crowd each time. So I want to see like if people are getting it or how the reaction is. And I'm just feeling like, when am I going to stop watching this film? I just can't help it because each time the crowd changes and I want to feel what people are feeling. And so for me in Haiti, at first I had said, well, I'm not going to watch it because I won't be able to take it, you know, if like people like start, you know, like they start sucking their teeth or whatever. And because they would do that, you know. And so then I had to sit in it, but I sat in the audience and I watched it and just felt every emotion that was like being felt. I was feeling it at the same time. And so at the end when, you know, people got up and they like, you know, gave these long speeches about what the film felt, for what the film felt like, the experience of the film. It was an experience. It wasn't just watching a film. They were experiencing the film. And so it was really moving for me to actually be there and share the film. And I did it in another place outside of Port-au-Prince. I did it in Jacmel, which is a city I lived in for 2 years.
Oh, Jacmel. Oh, that's a beautiful place right on the water.
And I did that at the Alliance Française, and it was a different type of screening. It was a younger crowd, and they just, you know, they're frustrated with people just sitting around praying and wanna, you know, they're like, you know, we've got to get this country moving. This is ridiculous, you know. They loved the film. They really got it. But they were like, you know, so for me, at first I was like, they didn't like, you know, the film or what? What's going on here? But and then in hindsight, I realized that, you know, the youth is really, like, they want change. They want things to move forward. They're like, you know, they want to break away from the tradition, you know, of being passive and just sitting around, you know, like praying to God, but just moving and making things happen. They want to be engaged. So the whole discussion afterwards in Jacmel was about faith and social engagement, basically. And so we talked about that, how you can have spirituality, but at the same time be completely engaged in your society and move your country forward. It can't be just, you know, a kind of spirituality that weighs you down, you know. And so we talked about that. So it was interesting. It was the first time that we actually talked after a screening that I actually talked about, like, faith and spirituality. And people ask Dominique Batraville, who is the journalist and actor guy who we see in the beginning of the film, like, how do you deal with, like, three different, you know, religion? And so he explained it. It's a long story. I won't get into it, but he explains it, and he says that it's fine as long as you don't let it weigh you down, and you continue your work. But it's also a source of strength. He says, you know, we have a source of strength in this country, which is the fact that we do have, you know, voodoo as our traditional religion. We have the new faith, which is Catholicism and Protestant and so on and so forth. But if you can embrace them all and still, you know, carry on with your life and still be engaged socially in your society, then why not, basically? So we were having, like, really, you know, deep discussion about theology and social engagement, which is, for me, what the film is trying to do, is trying to find that balance between faith and social action. And okay, it's one on one end to have religion, but on the other end, you must be engaged, because the society really do need you, because we do have a very secular constitution. We're not like a religious state. So, and he also speaks of, like, you know, the city of God and the city of man, of really building our cities first before we can aspire to go to the, you know, to the city of God, basically, if that's your belief. And to answer your question, no, a lot of the
go ahead and ask my question, and I'll ask you another question.
Yes, a lot of the participants were not there because the screening happened in a place which was not very, very close to the cathedral. It's in the city, but it's just, you know, Port-au-Prince has, like, sectors and neighborhoods, and sometimes people have a hard time leaving their neighborhoods to go to another neighborhood. And since the city, the French Institute is a very, it's an institute that's been around in the country for over 50 years, but it's also for, you know, the intellectual mass, and people who read, basically, and mm-hmm. and people who are, you know, who are aware of different things that are going on culturally in the country. And a lot of the participants in the film are people who are homeless and who live around the cathedral, or people who are part of the congregation but who do not live who do not live in the neighborhood of the institute. So the mm-hmm. idea is to go back and actually do a huge screening on the cathedral square,
yeah,
and we're working on that in mm-hmm. for 3 months' time, for us to go back and actually do something major so everyone can see the film. But I did have one participant, and it was Dominique Batraville, who is the journalist, actor, writer, individual who speaks about, you know, who takes us to that street where it was, you know, old bookstores, you know?
Yes.
You remember
mm-hmm.
that?
Yes.
Yeah. Who takes us on that walk down mm-hmm. the old bookstore, the street, you know, that sold, like, book, where you had like all the book vendors,
mm-hmm.
And so he was there and he loved the film, and he came to Jacmel with me, and he actually mm-hmm. sort of like mediated the whole discussion after the film.
Nice.
In Jacmel. Yeah, it was really
awesome.
Wonderful. So we spent a weekend together with him,
mm-hmm.
You know, within Jacmel and for the screening, and it was wonderful to have him there because he was really able to sort of like mediate that discussion with the audience
mm-hmm.
and get them going. Basically, the audience was kind of shy in the beginning, and then you know he got the discussion going.
Mm-hmm.
But
nice.
Yeah, but he was there, and you know he gave his impression of the film, and it's kind of like he's biased because he's also in the film. But you know, it was great to hear from him, like you know, like that I did a really, really great job,
mm-hmm.
and he really loved the film. And so that's also important when people in your film really appreciate the work.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I really liked him. You know what he said in the film about, you know, holding on to his traditional faith and doing, you know, a synthesis the way most of our ancestors did, you know, when they came from Africa to the various parts of the Western Hemisphere.
Right.
You know, if the religion that they encountered was Christianity, a lot of times they held on to their African faith and just adapted it and made it work together, because you know it's all about the same thing. You know, and, you know, when
no,
you look
it's
at it all.
True, it's
mm-hmm.
true. And the thing is, you know, like the African slaves didn't come to the New World with drums, and yet they knew how to play drums, you know. So it's like, it's
mm-hmm.
very ancestral, you know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
it was they wanted to repeat their tradition at the same time. So they had to also, you know, like hide behind Christianity at the same time to be able to practice their old religion.
Mm-hmm.
When you take voodoo, like gives like, you know, Catholic names to a lot of the spirits, because
mm-hmm.
it was a way for them to, you know, to hide behind Catholicism. So there is a way where you can actually navigate both and, you know, and find your strength in both.
Mm-hmm.
And in Haiti, it allows you to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then when, you know, President Aristide, you know, making voodoo a national religion, that sort of gave it, what do you call it, not authenticity, but legitimized it, because voodoo is seen, you know, in a real negative way in Western culture because of, you know, film and other ways of projecting it in a negative way that doesn't even reflect the true essence of the religion or the spiritual practice. But I wanted to also mention that this particular subject, you actually, I think, used some film footage of him in a film, I think, in your
right.
film. Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And also I wanted you to talk about, because we're running out of time, my other guest is in the studio, but I wanted you to talk about that whole thing around Job, and I thought that was a really interesting metaphor.
You know, when the quake first happened, one of the images that I saw, like right after the rescuers came and international television came, were people who were just, you know, who were praying, and they were singing, mm-hmm. you know, religious songs, and they were praying, and that kind of like, you know, unrelenting faith, no matter what, is really where the resilience comes from. It's really that kind of like, you know, it's hoping that the world will be better. And I had to go back into the Bible to actually find the kind of reference that really reminded me of what, you know, Haitians have, you know, been suffering for the last few, you know, centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, our disaster was a disaster of biblical proportion. And since I was dealing with this, you know, with this institution, which is, you know, this religious institution, I went back, I did my research. I mean, I could have used, you know, the story of Sisyphus, you know, like in Greek mythology, who's like destined to like push his rock up, you know, uphill that keeps rolling down, but he still believes that he's going to be able to, you know, get it over the hill, at
mm-hmm.
least to the top of the hill, and he just keeps going. But there was something defeatist about that, and there was also something, you know, very, very, it's too heady and too intellectual. And I wanted to really stay loyal to what I saw in Haiti, to what, you know, to who the Haitians are. And there are people, you know, they're believing people, they're righteous people, no one's you know, is an atheist in Haiti. They have some kind of faith, some kind of belief, you know, in a higher power. And Job, the book of Job for me really, really resonated with what the Haitians are going through. And so, and that's how he sort of like, you know, find himself in there. And, you know, when you decide whether you're going to do a narration or not, and you don't necessarily want it to be about you, because it's not like, you know, it's not one of those like navel gazing films. It's not about me. It's about my compatriots in Haiti and how they are negotiating this disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had to reflect also who they are. And although I'm someone who's sort of like parted ways with organized religion a long time ago, I had to go back. I had to go back and really sort of like, you know, understand where this resilience is coming from. And I have to say that it's a word that I hated, because every time that they talked about it on mainstream television, it meant that we know how to suffer. And I find that deeply troubling, because I think, you know, like, okay, you can't just, you know how to suffer. At some point, you have to have solution to this suffering. But, you know, being in Haiti and seeing it and feeling it is really, for me, is where that resilience comes from, is really that sense of like, you know what, it has to get better. It can't
mm-hmm.
stay the way that it is. And also Pierre Cliton, who's one of the participants in the film, he says that we have a refusal to see the world as it is. We always, where we're living in hope, hoping that things will be better, that the world has to be beautiful and has to be, you know, like this magical place that you see in Haitian paintings, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we're definitely going to have you on again, Getty, to talk about your other film, the one that's still in the, I don't know what the term is for, but it's not finished yet, another film along this particular theme. I don't know how to pronounce the name of it, though. How do you pronounce it? The name of it, Tales of?
The Tales of Gudu Gudu, which is how the quake, the name for the quake. It's an onomatopoeia of the sound that the ground made when it shook.
Oh, my.
Gudu Gudu.
Yeah, we have to have you on again to talk about that, as well as this wonderful experience you had. And we'll let our audience know that you'll be able to meet the director and see her film, Broken Stones, at the is closing the African Film Festival, which is at the Berkeley Art Museum Pacific Film Archives through February 5th. So there are three more screenings. I'm not certain. I know there's one Sunday, and I know there's one Tuesday, which is the 5th. But there's
right.
another one. Is it today or was it?
There's a screening today, and there's a screening on Sunday also, I believe.
Okay. I thought there was a screening tomorrow, but I don't remember. So there's a screening tonight and a screening on Sunday.
I could pull up the schedule right here. But,
okay. Yeah, I just know there's three more weeks.
I can pull up the schedule for you. But I just wanted to make a correction that the film that's showing before mine is called Under One Roof, and it's shot in Johannesburg in South Africa. And it's showing with my film on Tuesday night, and that screening is starting at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that should be wonderful. Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking forward to being a part of that, you know, that festival. I mean, they have some really amazing films that they're showing, and it's so great, because I think, you know, it's we're so far from Africa here, so it's really getting, you know, like a piece of, you know, that continent, you know, right here, so far from the continent is really great. It's a great experience for a lot of people. And for me, I miss the African continent. When I live in France, I was much closer to it, so I feel like, you know, I'm missing it, like, very, very deeply, so.
And I want to let audiences know that they can stay in touch with Getty by visiting her website, bellmoonproductions.com. And, Getty, did you find the information? Because I only have like a couple, 10 more minutes.
I'm pulling it up right now. I'm looking at the calendar. And tonight, there's not a film tonight on the program.
Is it tomorrow?
Tomorrow night, Screeners Film Festival. They're doing a screening for, yes, African Film Festival at 8:20.
Right.
There's a film tomorrow night.
Okay.
I love the fact that the picture of my film is actually what is on the calendar for the African Festival. My film is the poster child. So there's more screening. There's Saturday on the 2nd, tomorrow night, How to Steal 2 Million at 8:20.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday, February 3rd at 2:30, Our Beloved Sudan. And then on Tuesday, February 5th at 7 p.m., Broken Stones, preceded by Under One Roof, which is a portrait of the residents of Johannesburg's tallest building.
Right.
And, I'd like to, you know, this is so great. I'd like to give a shout-out to Kathy Gertes for really putting this great program together and having my film within the series as a diaspora film. She's doing a really, really great job. And Mahen Bonetti, of course, for putting the whole, you know, African cinema, bringing African cinema to the United States for the last 21 years or so. She's such a good person. Yeah.
Okay, Getty. Well, it's been fabulous.
I look forward to meeting everyone, and my crew for the film is going to be there. My husband will be there. My sons will be there because one son did sound and the other son did music. So,
Okay. All right, Getty. You take good care.
Thank you so much, Wanda, for having me on.
Okay.
Take care.
Blessings.
Bye.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Idris Akamor and African Jamal Davis for hanging in there. We'll definitely have to have you all on again for a much longer time. So, Idris, you sent me an email with all of these wonderful accolades that you received on the tour and after the tour with the pyramids.
Yeah.
You have a concert coming up, I believe, at the 57th Street Gallery.
Yeah, we have a series of concerts coming up, actually. The first one is going to be at the 57th Street Gallery on Sunday, February 10th, in the afternoon at 3 p.m. And followed by two shows at the Fillmore Jazz Heritage Center, which will be Friday and Saturday, February 15th and 16th at 8 p.m.
Okay.
Then African American Art and Culture. We're going to be at San Francisco State University.
Wow.
For kind of a master's recital. That's on Wednesday the 13th in the afternoon.
All this is in February?
All this is in February, yes, all in the month of the early first 2 weeks of February.
Wow.
Yeah. So actually we got six performances through a grant from the Irvine Foundation.
Yeah, it was pretty significant grant too.
Yes, and the end result is for us to build. We're going to build a community orchestra of basically of non-professional musicians, anybody who has an instrument or wants to, you know, perform live. And we're going to do 3 outdoor shows in October with this orchestra.
Nice. So how do people get in touch with Culture Odyssey? Who want to participate in this community orchestra?
Well, they can definitely call me at 415-292-1850, or they can go to our website, you know, culturalodyssey.org, www.culturalodyssey.org, and contact me through that. But these concerts that we're having are kind of, we're going to use them as a kind of a recruitment tool. So when people come to the concert, they can actually sign up to be a part of the orchestra.
Oh, that's going to be cool. And so it's all ages? I mean, young people as well as older
ages.
People?
All ages. Yeah.
But you already have to know how to play an instrument?
No, you don't even have to know how to play it. You just have to want to have the desire.
Really?
Yeah, you just have to want to have the desire.
Since I
want
to learn how to play bass, I could actually come and take lessons?
Well, there's definitely going to be a lot of percussion instruments to play, and that's always the first thing to begin with. But we don't actually have Shima is going to be probably on hand. So he's the reigning upright bass player in the Bay Area, and he'll be on all these shows. Shima Mark Williams.
Yes.
And normally you'd have to, if you want to play a percussion, it's either bring your instrument, or we also have percussion instruments, or if you have a bass, bring it, and you can basically thumb around until you fit in.
Oh, wow, because
you can play one note.
We're really
you can play
wonderful.
One note, come.
One note, no note. your concerts that you had... the concerts you had here before you went on the European tour were just phenomenal. I mean, it was just fantastic. So are you bringing that similar kind of ritual to these other spaces that you're going to be performing at over the next six concerts?
Absolutely. It's going to be members of the pyramids. And what we pride ourselves in that we do create ritual. We create a kind of a magic ritual on stage. And we will have basically a couple of guests joining us. Sandy Poindexter is going to be sitting in for Kimathi Asante, who is on electric bass, but she's going to be sitting in for him because he's in Toledo, Ohio.
Okay.
So Sandy's going to be joining us.
Nice.
And also Redessa will probably join us for one of these shows at the Brava Theater. Redessa, my partner, will join us on Friday, February 22nd.
And what's Redessa going to be doing?
We're going to be doing music. She's going to be sitting in and perform some of the music that she's going to be utilizing in her upcoming show, The Resurrection of She.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's going to be a Brava too, right?
Yeah, which is going to be a Brava later in the end of March. So we're going to be we're basically in residence at Brava, and so we'll be creating some of the music. And then Redessa would join us for several selections on that evening on February 22nd at Brava, 8 p.m.
Oh, that's nice. Because the evening that I went to your home concert series, she was the mistress of ceremonies, and that's, she's always just so elegant, and she had on her crown. It was just so fabulous.
I was really good to see you at the show, actually.
So we'll have to have you on again to talk about Europe. But I'm sure you know African Jamal Davis because he's just so famous, with the Bajaba Showcase and his other shows, I think, at KKUP. Is that correct?
That is. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes, Idris, long time. I have a couple of your albums that from time to time get some airplay.
Oh, that's great. That's definitely appreciated, too. I'd like to hopefully I'll get a chance to see some of the stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, and if you have anything recently recorded, I'd love to get a copy of it and get some exposure on that as well.
We sure have our latest album just got released, actually. The first album, the first Pyramids album in 35 years, called Otherworldly.
Wow. So give me a contact number so we can hit one another once we get done here.
Yeah. That's a good way. Good connection, Wanda. Yeah. My number. Yeah, call me at 415-292-5589.
All right, I will.
And I'll get you a copy of it.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Idris, didn't you tell me the list of all, I mean, like, the accomplishments and the things you've been doing since I last saw you are just like so many pages. is the box set out yet for the pyramid?
Yes, it is.
Okay, gosh, okay.
I forgot.
Yeah, I want a copy of that. That is so cool.
I have to reserve it. It is phenomenal. The box set is a 48-page insert booklet.
Ooh, 48 pages. A book
inside of it.
Nice.
And the three 70s Pyramids CDs, Lalibela, King of Kings, and Birth Speed Merging. Mm-hmm. And to top that, on the back of Birth Speed Merging is an enhanced CD with a video of the only pyramid show filmed in the 70s at KQED.
Oh, wow.
So you pop the CD in the computer and you watch the film.
Wow, that is awesome.
Yes.
That's really awesome. Oh, yeah, that is just, congratulations.
Thank you. So I'll hold one aside for you for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And call me.
Oh, I certainly will. And okay. African, I'm sure, is going to be in touch.
Okay, yeah, African, call me, and I'll get you that. I'll get you some of the new stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you will definitely hear from me.
Okay, I'll let y'all get on with y'all thing, and I got to go to rehearsal.
Okay, cool. Thanks so much for popping in, Idris.
Okay, thanks, Wanda. Thank you.
Okay, peace and blessings.
Okay, peace, dear.
Yeah.
Keep swinging.
So, African, so good to have you on to talk about the concert tonight at the 57th Street Gallery. It's the second of two, and this one here is, you had one last week, and this week tonight is honoring Billy Higgins, but is featuring a group of musicians and an organization that Billy helped, he co-founded. Tell us about the concert and this organization and the concert tonight.
Yeah, it's an artist collective. Life Force Jazz Records was co-founded by Billy Higgins and Dwan Muhammad.
Oh, okay.
And it's a very unique label in that it's a nonprofit label. It has a 501(c).
Mm-hmm.
The other wonderful thing about it, Billy and Dwan wanted to create something for musicians to get their work out in the world and own their work. So all of the over 60 titles that are on the label, the masters are owned by the musicians. The label owns no masters at all. And that way an artist can maintain ownership of their work,
mm-hmm.
and get full benefits in terms of publishing rights and royalties and all of that. And the label was founded in 1994, and it was an offshoot from an organization that Billy Higgins formed in L.A. when he was in L.A. called the World Stage.
Right.
And, one of the Bay Area musicians of note who came through that system, the World Stage and Black Jazz Records, Marcus Shelby.
Oh.
And so tonight we will pay tribute to Billy Higgins, but celebrate Life Force Jazz Records.
Mm-hmm.
And coming in from L.A. is James Leary on bass, and flying out from Las Vegas is Clifford Adams. He's with Kool & the Gang, and they are performing in Las Vegas. So he's going to, I guess they're having an off night, so he'll be there tonight.
Good for us,
huh? Yeah. And the Bajabans, as we affectionately refer to our Bay Area musicians, Altez Medeiros-Aday, Modesto Senio, Leon Joyce, Dwan Muhammad, Calvin Keys, Elmer Gibson, who flew in from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Wow.
And all of these cats are Life Force Jazz artists, and most of them have some kind of work or an album on Life Force Jazz.
Nice.
And we're recording this, and I will be emceeing it, and we also are going to give an award from a artist and collective group called the Order of the Flask. We have a Lifetime Achievement Award, and tonight we will give that to James Leary. And it's called the Bajaba Maisha Ya Kaza Bora Award. And Bajaba is an acronym for Bay Area Jazz and Blues Artists, and Maisha Ya Kaza Bora is Swahili for Lifetime Achievement.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, that's awesome. That's really awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That is really great. So, Dewan Muhammad, what is his instrument?
He plays all reeds.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And he's a Bajaban here. He lives here now?
Yes, he is. And he's the co-founder of Life Force Jazz Records. And
wow.
Single-handedly, he has kept it afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And pertinent to the community, the world community, world stages.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is really phenomenal. That's wonderful. Well, I wish I had something from Life Force Jazz Records to play. That would be so fitting. So we'll have to play something.
I didn't know you had a radio show. If I'd been given some advance notice, I would have made sure that you get to, I'll make sure you get a good collection of Life Force Jazz Records.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I'm coming tonight. I was really, really funny. I was driving home from a stage reading. Lorraine Hansberry Theater's been traveling, and so they had a stage reading of a play by Keith Joseph Atkins last Friday night at the East Bay Center for Performing Arts, and so I was driving home, and I was listening to KPFA, and I was listening to, I heard Ken's voice. I'm like, oh, that's Ken, and he was giving away tickets to the concert, and I've never won any tickets before. And I'm like, I call, say, hey, Ken, is this you? And he said, yeah. And I'm like, And I said, are the tickets still available? And they were. And so it's like, he said, what weekend do you want? Last weekend or this? I said, this weekend. And so I won some tickets. I'm like, so excited. And I said, well, can I have you on the air to talk about Billy Higgins and Life Force Jazz Records? And he told me that, you know, he was just making the announcement that, you know, you were the, you know, sort of like the person to speak to. But anyway. It took a while for us to be able to, like, get it together insofar as the communication, so that's why you got such late notice.
better late than never.
Oh, certainly, definitely.
Yeah, also, I'd like to plug tomorrow at KPFA.
Yeah, you're having a live show.
Live show. The first Saturday of every month, we have a live performance in the studio at KPFA called the Java Showcase Live.
Mm-hmm.
And Achutan.
Oh, Achutan? Oh, my God, right. My favorite drummer.
Yes, he will be there with a quintet tomorrow. You are invited to drum by.
Oh, wow, Achutan. What time is the concert?
11 p.m.
We hit it
11, and it plays for an hour, and then... And we go back to recorded music. So.
Oh, okay. Well, let's take my vitamins so I can be out late.
Yeah. Vitamin, as Avachi would say, vitamin B flat.
Yes. Uh-huh. With a C. And
yeah.
A A too, maybe.
There you go. There you dolly well are.
Okay, super. Well, thank you so much. And can you maybe give folks some websites so they can stay in touch with you and also find out more about Life Force Jazz Records? And do you all have a concert series? I mean, are there going to be other concerts happening with other members of the label?
I believe so. You know, we made a great connection with Floyd Pelham, and so I think some more things will be happening there. LifeForceJazz.com, my website. If you just Google my name, it'll come up. African Jamal Davis, spelled AfricanJahmalDavis. Or either go to KKUP.org or KPFA.org. and find the shows there and click on there. And a whole bunch of different ways to hook up with me. And
okay.
I'll more than happy to share what's going on with Life Force Jazz and the Java Showcase and all of the other madness that I'm mixed in with.
Yeah, you're keeping the music alive for sure.
Yes, ma'am. That's
really appreciate that. Yeah, yeah. We really miss Doug Edwards. But you know, you all have been keeping him alive and his work alive, which is we really appreciate that.
I absolutely will. He's the founder of the Java Showcase.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. He and I co-produced that in the early 2000s. So as of today, as of tomorrow, we will have done about 64 of these.
Mm, wow. That's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, it's not happening anywhere else. You know, the Java Showcase, you know, featuring and highlighting Bay Area, you know, jazz artists.
Yeah.
Mhm. Yeah.
Evolution of the Blues.
Mhm. Yeah. Well, I don't have any Life Force jazz record artists, but I know you know Donald Duck Bailey, so I'm going to play one of his pieces.
I do. He is a Bajavan, and by the way, he is on Chester Smith's album, which is on Life Force Jazz.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah.
Excellent. Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I will see you later on today at Floyd Pelham 67 Street Gallery at the concert. What time is the concert?
8 o'clock, and that address is 5701 Telegraph Avenue in Oakland.
All righty. Cool. All righty. You take good care. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. You do. Bye-bye.
Peace and blessings. Bye-bye.
To you, too.
We'll be right back.